Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group in partnership with Roslyn Capital. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today we check in with the Trump transition team.
All this nonsense about internal turmoil, I can pretty much tell you who that is. That's probably A, people who are bitter that Mr. Trump won the election, or B, people who have sour grapes that they're not on the president-elect's list of folks under consideration for political appointments.
The Trump tweets continue to stir up controversy.
If anything, fan base has been increasing out in America. People like his style.
We'll also look at the death of Fidel Castro and the disturbing reaction from Canada.
The prime minister of a free country has deep sorrow on the death of a tyrant?
And Senator Ted Cruz weighs in.
What Obama has done is funneled billions of dollars to Raul Castro, which is being used to oppress dissidents.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. During the presidential election, Donald Trump made this controversial statement during the final debate with Hillary Clinton. The question comes from Chris Wallace.
Do you make the same commitment that you will absolutely, sir, that you will absolutely accept the result of this election?
I will look at it at the time. I'm not looking at anything now. I'll look at it at the time.
Personalities in the elite media outlets nearly fainted. The statement certainly wasn't the wisest. I criticized it at the time. But the electorate has grown accustomed to off-the-cuff and controversial statements from Donald Trump, and it did not stop his momentum. Instead of hurting him, in fact, Trump went on to win 306 electoral votes, well beyond what he needed to become the next president of the United States. His was a clear and a commanding win. Hillary conceded. Then came Jill Stein, the underfunded third-party candidate who garnered a mere 1% of the vote in an election with historically unpopular major party candidates. Stein is now demanding a recount in three states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. I've called that a scam on television and on my radio show. It is a scam. The effort is also futile at best. What makes it interesting is the fact that Hillary is on board. This Hillary.
Donald said something, well, he said a lot of things that were troubling, but he said something truly horrifying. He became the first person running for president, Republican or Democrat, who refused to say that he would respect the results of this election. Now, that is a direct threat to our democracy.
That's horrifying. You know, every time Donald thinks things are not going in his direction, he claims whatever it is rigged against him. That is not the way our democracy works.
Once again, the hypocritical underbelly of the Democratic Party is exposed. Meanwhile, Donald Trump continued on his way, announcing his impressive list of cabinet nominees, meeting with many other potential members. But probably the most controversial meeting Trump has had was with the last Republican presidential nominee, Mitt Romney, whose name has been in the mix for Secretary of State under President Trump. As the week began, I spoke with Politico's Mike Allen about a possible Romney appointment and all the criticism it had stirred up within Team Trump. Kellyanne Conway launches an unexpected, you know, massive MERV assault on Mitt Romney yesterday. What is the backstory, Mike Allen? Because I love Kellyanne. She's been a guest on the show hundreds of times. I am a great fan of Governor Romney. I thought today we would see General Mattis and Mitt Romney on either side of Donald Trump, triumphant team of rivals. And then Kellyanne, you know, a little bit of a shot across the bow last week, kind of a genuflection to the base. But then yesterday, dropping the big one on Mitt Romney. What is that?
There's no way that this is not authorized by Donald Trump. There's no way that it's not okay with the president-elect. I don't think she would have done it the first time if this were not at his behest, but there's no way she would have quadrupled down like she did yesterday. So I can tell you that from in Romney world and Romney circles, even her first comments were taken as a clear signal this isn't happening.
Now, the Morning Joe lowered third is Trump furious with Kellyanne Conway. You're not crediting that.
I don't know. I just don't know. Who knows in this world, right? Like, who knows what's going on in that tower? I can tell you that based on history, there's very few people, there are no occasions where someone close to Trump does something that is contrary to his wishes and does it again and again and again and stays close to him. That just doesn't happen.
So why go to this great length to antagonize the Romneyites, unless it's payback, which is not a good sign for going forward?
I think it reflects the authentic thinking of a lot of people close to Trump. We don't know that it reflects Trump's thinking, but we know that it's okay with him, that it's occurring. And that is that he likes a little bit of chaos out there. And maybe he likes contrasting views out there. And it's part of his showmanship. This has been a very unusual transition in that we've had essentially auditions. People have been free to go out and talk about their own possibilities and talk themselves up. Some people said that that didn't particularly help Mayor Giuliani. But this hasn't been the cloistered, button-down process that it usually is. And that seems to work for him. As we talk to people back home at Thanksgiving, I was down in Raleigh where we fried two turkeys, baked a third, had an epic cranium game, 22 people in a cranium game. We had the college students versus their parents who were going to see if they were getting their money's worth. But you, as people went around the country for Thanksgiving, there was just a fascination with Trump. And if anything, his fan base has been increasing out in America. People like his style. And we see that's part of what we see with this very, very, very unusual transition process where people are out talking about things that are usually very closely held. And so the Kellyanne comments may be partly to send messages, partly to test reactions, but it's not surprising the president-elect.
There are plenty of rumors about the transition and how difficult it has been. My Salem colleague, Mike Gallagher, went right to the communications director of the Trump transition team, Jason Miller.
Jason, I have to tell you, I don't know how you pulled yourself away from all the turmoil that I read that you guys are in the middle of. It's like World War III over there. There's things, desks are being turned over. No one can figure anything out. I mean, the mainstream media is doing a great job in accurately reporting all the terrible turmoil going on during this transition, correct?
Yeah, something like that, Mike. And, you know, it cracks me up that you know, it's not enough that Mr. Trump won the presidency and that he's now our president-elect. But now it's why don't you have your complete cabinet formed after 1 week? Or, you know, how come we're not given a seat next to you at dinner so we can see if you're ordering the bone-in or the filet?
Right. How dare you go out to dinner without telling Hallie Jackson from NBC News? I mean, this is a terrible, terrible scandal. This man went out to dinner without asking the media for permission. I mean, how dare he?
But, the thing that folks should know is that we have some really cool people that are coming through. And, you know, I look at the list of who Mr. Trump is meeting with. He's starting to form his administration and start to chat with people who are real smart and have some good ideas how to put things together. And, you know, he's meeting in this next hour with Henry Kissinger and, you know, as the CEO of FedEx, Fred Smith coming through, and Governor Nikki Haley, and then all sorts of great people that are coming through and chatting with him to give him ideas. And as he thinks about how best to form the actual working government so we can go and drain the swamp and do all these great things. But all this nonsense about internal turmoil, that's I can pretty much tell you who that is. That's probably A, people who are bitter that Mr. Trump won the election, or B, people who have sour grapes that they're not on the president-elect's list of folks under consideration for political appointments. And when you talk about draining the swamp, here's what they do. If you're not on some short list, then they go and try to push stories against
you. And let's look at option C. It's an adversarial news media. I mean, let's be honest here, and I just want to brace our listeners for this, embrace the country, because if you thought the media was confrontational and adversarial during the campaign, if we think they're gonna you know, turn over a new leaf and suddenly be fair and objective and impartial during the Trump administration, we're delusional. It's not going to happen, Jason. And everything the man tries to do is going to be met, unfortunately and sadly and tragically, by that continual tidal wave of resistance from the mainstream media. No?
Well, I think you're onto something there, and I think there's also the aspect of, I think part of what made President-elect Trump such an effective communicator is he found these additional ways to communicate with voters that don't require going through the conventional media filter. And so there are a lot of good folks in the media who are just trying to do their jobs, and there are some who I think would have preferred that Mr. Trump not win the election. But when we talk about the use of Twitter or Facebook Live or these different ways to go and get the message right across, I would expect that he'll continue to do that and continue to take his message directly to the citizens of this country as we start moving into the phase of, hey, let's go and repeal and replace Obamacare. Let's go and pass some real tax cuts. I mean, these are, you know, it's drain the swamp. These are real things that are coming. He's going to need to rally folks to that cause.
Let's dig deep into some of the issues that we're hearing about and that we know are on the table. First of all, Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is reportedly being considered and is considering a role as special advisor to the president. I don't recall all this debate about who gets security clearance and who doesn't. I don't understand why this is such a big, complicated issue with Donald Trump and his family members. What is there something that's remarkably different from Ronald Reagan with his relationship with his daughter Maureen when he was president? I mean, I'm a little bit lost as to why this has been a big issue, other than my suspicion that it's a false narrative created by an adversarial news media.
Well, or in this case, even I think some of the insiders down in the swamp, I think, had something to do with this. But the fact of the matter is that the president-elect did not request for any of his family members to get security clearance. And Jared Kushner has not pursued a formal role within the White House structure. Is he a counselor and supporter of his father-in-law, the next president of the United States? Of course. And I'll tell you, having worked with Jared over the past 3 or 4 months, or I guess 4 or 5 months as time flies, he's brilliant. He's one of the innovative leaders in our digital and data program. Someone who I can see why the president-elect would seek his counsel on matters. He's a very sharp guy. Look, it's the core leadership team within the White House has been formed, and that's Chief Strategist Steve Bannon and Chief of Staff Reince Priebus. The two worked fantastic together during the campaign and helped Mr. Trump win a number of states that folks said that he'd never have a chance. And this exact same team that helped bring him the win is now going to go and help implement this legislative agenda.
When we return,
the Prime Minister of a free country has deep sorrow on the death of a tyrant?
The death of Fidel Castro, when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. On November 25th, the world was relieved of a tyrant. Fidel Castro, for 47 years the communist dictator of Cuba, died. For those familiar with his reign of torture and murder, it was a day to celebrate. For others, particularly the Prime Minister of Canada, it was a day of mourning. My fellow Salem host Dennis Prager has been a student of communism for decades. He weighed in on the response we witnessed.
The only thing worse than Fidel Castro are the Westerners who praised him all of these years. The European, the left, went gaga over the man, never stopped, still wear Che Guevara T-shirts. The inability to confront evil is exactly why I abandoned the left when I was a kid. To me, the most important thing you can do in life is fight cruelty and evil, and it is the only thing the left doesn't do. It fights carbon emissions. It fought anti-communists. It fights corporations. It fights tobacco. But it doesn't fight evil. And the greatest example came from Canada, where you went from the greatest prime minister in the Western world to, he's not the worst, Trudeau, he's just a nothing, like the rest of the leftists. He doesn't even know what he stands for. He's been made a fool of, actually, by his comments on the death of Fidel Castro. I will read you it is in entirety. You have to believe the man knows nothing about him. There's no other possible answer. And who wrote this for him? I mean, the people who wrote it for him in the Canadian government, in his administration, must know something about Fidel Castro. The Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, issued the following statement on the death of former Cuban President Fidel Castro. By the way, you will note, this was Bruce Hershenson made this point many years ago, left-wing dictators are called president. Right-wing dictators are called dictators. It is with deep sorrow. Wow. The Prime Minister of a free country has deep sorrow on the death of a tyrant? You gotta assimilate that, my friends. That I learned today of the death of Cuba's longest-serving president. Who wrote this? Is there competition for Cuba's longest-serving president? It's such a funny statement. Fidel Castro was a larger-than-life leader who served his people for almost half a century. Actually, he ruined his people for more than a half century, as it happens. He ruined. I will read to you the data on what Fidel Castro inherited and what he left. He ruined the country. An entire generation, two generations of Cubans, allowed to do nothing. Nothing. That's what you're allowed to do in a communist country. Did you know that? You are allowed to do nothing. I have been to many communist countries. That was my field of study. And I'm telling you, that's what it is. You are allowed to do nothing. You know what the chief characteristic of a communist country is? Boredom. Oppressive boredom. You can't say what you think. You can't read what you want. You can't listen to what you want. You can't travel where you want. You can't work as you want. You can't study what you want. But you do get to bring your own Band-Aids to a hospital. The Justin Trudeau statement is a disgrace to decency. It is a disgrace.
Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio both have parents born in Cuba. The evil committed by Castro is close to home for them both. So on the Hugh Hewitt Show, I pulled tape from both of those men. Ted Cruz was on with ABC This Week yesterday. Here's what he had to say. Cut number 7.
Well, look, that is certainly my hope and my prayer. Unfortunately, the policies of the Obama administration have made that less likely. What the Obama administration has done is strengthened Raul Castro. Raul is the dictator now. I asked my dad at dinner last night, well, what do you think happens now that Fidel is dead? And he shrugged and said, Raul's been in charge for years. That the system has gotten stronger. And what Obama has done is funneled billions of dollars to Raul Castro, which is being used to oppress dissidents. You know, in 2015, roughly 10,000 political arrests occurred in Cuba. That is five times as many as occurred in 2010, when there were only about 2,000. This tyrannical regime has gotten stronger because of a weak president, weak foreign policy, and it is very much my hope and belief that with a new president coming into office in January, President Trump, a new administration, that U.S. foreign policy, not just to Cuba, but towards our enemies, whether they are Iran or North Korea, will no longer be a policy of weakness and appeasement, but instead using U.S. strength to force and press for change. But I look for the day. You know, I've never been to Cuba. I've never been to the land where my father was born, where he grew up. I look forward to coming to Cuba, but to seeing a free Cuba where people can live, where it's pulled out of.
So do you think the embargo was working?
Time forgot.
Marco Rubio on Fox talking about Fidel. Cut number 4.
First, I want to ask about President-elect Donald Trump. He has called President Obama's move to normalize relations with Cuba a weak agreement. But in the past, he also expressed interest in opening a hotel in Cuba, saying it's okay to bring Cuba back into the fold. What will you be demanding of the Trump administration vis-a-vis Cuba?
Well, first of all, the thing you outline about Donald Trump happened a long time ago. He has since then said that that's not, they never went forward with it, and he has since changed this position. And we're always, like I said, for many people, Cuba is an issue they're not dealing with every single day unless you live down here in Miami. And so we're always looking to change people's minds on it. And since that time, as a candidate for president, he made very clear that he felt that the moves that President Obama had made towards Cuba were wrong, and that he would examine them and change the ones that needed to be changed. And I think that's very promising. So what I argue is, number one, our goal is the national security and national interest of the United States, and as part of that, to do everything possible through our foreign policy towards Cuba to incentivize and pave the way for the move towards democracy. So, and we should examine our policy towards Cuba through those lenses. And if there's a policy that helps that, it remains in place. And if it's a policy that doesn't, it's removed. And that's what I would encourage them to do, and I look forward to working with them on that.
Senator, you called President Obama pathetic for offering condolences to Fidel Castro's
Absolutely.
Family. But, you know, he wasn't the only world leader to do so. And even Pope Francis sent a telegram expressing sentiments of sorrow. As a practicing Catholic, what's your reaction to that?
Well, as a practicing Catholic, I believe in the theological authority of the Bishop of Rome, and that's what Pope Francis is. On political matters, however, particularly on foreign policy issues, I don't necessarily believe that binds those of us in the faith in terms of issues of foreign policy. I still respect it, but that's a very different thing. Pope Francis is the leader of a religious organization, the Roman Catholic Church. Barack Obama is the president of the most powerful country in the world. And what I call pathetic is not mentioning whatsoever in that statement the reality that there are thousands upon thousands of people who suffered brutally under the Castro regime. He executed people. He jailed people for 20 to 30 years. The Florida Straits, there are thousands of people who lost their lives fleeing his dictatorship. And not to acknowledge any of that in the statement, I felt is pathetic. Absolutely.
Coming up.
If you want to come here, that's great. We have to know who you are, have to know what your background is. And secondly, if you want to be an American, you have to act like an American and integrate.
The Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Early this week, we witnessed what appeared to be a lone wolf terror attack as one man drove into a crowd of people at The Ohio State University and jumped out with a knife and continued his attack. Within moments, the terrorist was shot and killed by police. He was a Somali-born refugee who had come to this country after years in Pakistan, a convert to radical Islam. Those facts amped up the call to reconsider the current refugee program. Salem host Mike Gallagher spoke with terror expert Sebastian Gorka.
There are events, real-world events, that are occurring before our eyes, which remind us that the American people really did make the right decision in electing Donald Trump president. There's no question that we would have been filled with a sense of dread after yesterday's attack at Ohio State University, knowing that Hillary Clinton was going to be entrusted with trying to deal with these kinds of terrorists. It's a different story with Donald Trump, isn't it?
Absolutely. Before the election, people would ask me what happens if she wins. And I said, I can't go there mentally, spiritually. I can't do it because it would be a catastrophe for the United States, not just constitutionally, but in terms of national security. This is why extreme vetting that Donald Trump has spoken about is common sense. This administration has let in 50,000 Somali refugees in the last 8 years. If you look at the attacks in America, more than half of the attacks in the last 15 years have been done by immigrants or people not born in this country. So the idea that Hillary Clinton would have quintupled the number of people coming to America from countries like Syria is the threat that has to be dealt with. And on January 20th, there will be a new president. His name is Donald Trump, and we will see a national security response that is requisite and relevant to the level of the threat we face today as Americans.
Certainly not every Somali refugee who is a devout Muslim wants to do harm to innocent Americans. And yet, if you're thoroughly vetting and scrutinizing people who want to enter the United States, just again, the numbers of it all, you're going to reduce or minimize or decrease the chances of an attack like the one we saw yesterday in Columbus, aren't we?
Right. So there's two key issues here. It is not the fact that somebody is a Muslim that is the problem. Muslims have died wearing the uniform of the United States since September the 11th. The question is, people coming in large numbers from active war zones who cannot be effectively vetted when they arrive in the United States, number one. And number two is the other issue, which is very related to this attack yesterday and to other ones in Minnesota and other plots. It's the question of the lack of integration of immigrants. When you create the situation where the melting pot concept is no longer valid, people come to this country, don't have to learn the language, don't have to integrate. Those communities will be hotbeds of recruitment for people like this attacker yesterday. So if you want to come here, that's great. We have to know who you are, have to know what your background is. And secondly, if you want to be an American, you have to act like an American and integrate. Those two things are paramount.
You believe the whole dialogue will change once Trump becomes president?
Totally, totally.
And I expect that, again, my theory with the liberal media is they're not going to try to provide him any cover, so they'll be perfectly willing to call a terror attack for a change.
Look, the fact is the liberal media still doesn't understand what happened 2.5 weeks ago. They really are still isolated in a bulletproof cocoon whereby if they say that this has nothing to do with religion and these people are really the victims, this is the most outrageous thing. They try and make the perpetrators out to be the victims. You know, remember what was said about the Orlando shooter. He was a closet homosexual who had repressed tendencies and was taking revenge on his Latin lover. I mean, they'll invent stuff out of whole cloth that is totally and utterly fallacious because they live in a bubble, and they still do. The rest of America understands the threat. They voted for Donald Trump, and he will bring security.
I have to tell you, you're so right about the media still in shock over the election. I watched for 5 minutes last night that poor, pathetic Don Lemon on CNN beat up this conservative commentator by shrieking at him, saying, "Do you call Donald Trump's victory a landslide? Do you call?" And the guy said, "Well, yeah, look at the electorate. It's not a landslide." And he's arguing with this guy about what the definition of landslide is. They're trying to marginalize and minimize Trump's victory by pretending that he just barely eked out a win over Hillary because they can't believe what happened. They still can't believe it. They're in shock.
Absolutely. And you know what? They are digging a deeper and deeper hole for themselves.
Indeed they are.
American people have spoken, and the left still don't. This is why you have this recount issue. They still don't understand.
Right.
You know, making Keith Ellison the head of the Democrat Party, again, proof they don't get it.
Coming up,
do they not at USA Today realize this is silly?
A look at media bias when the Town Hall Review returns. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Over the course of the 2016 election, Donald Trump and the provocative nature of his campaign made a couple of things very clear. The elite media outlets were very clearly biased against him, and they clearly missed the magnitude of what was happening in the country. Opinions were once reserved for the opinion section of a news outlet. Those days are long gone. Now even the headlines often read like a press release from the Democratic National Committee. Dennis Prager dug deeper.
My friends, it is very difficult to overstate the poor state of our news media. It's a very, very serious problem in the United States as they become propaganda. Well, they become propaganda arms. I'm going to give you three examples here from the USA Today, Los Angeles Times, and New York Times. All right. Is that pretty representative? I just don't happen to have the Washington Post in front of me physically. This one is just silly. The USA Today one, I just admit, is just silly. Ohio State attack could be terrorism. Do they not at USA Today realize this is silly? It's just plain silly. It could be terrorism. Could it be what else? Could it be workplace violence? What are the alternatives? Could it be the man was testing out butcher knives, see which one he wanted? He got it on TV. You know, there's always commercials for butcher knives. What else could it be? We have his Facebook statements. 11 hurt, suspect killed in terrifying day at university. And let me give you the three examples, then I'll go back to that. The LA Times, people of color are resilient amid fear. She can't shake the memory, the sneering faces, the screaming, the wrath. Francine Williams was one of about 30 black students in New York City to integrate Lafayette High School in Brooklyn in 1965. Before class let out one afternoon, a crowd had gathered outside the predominantly Italian-American neighborhood of Bensonhurst. Her teacher assured her that the school had a plan for this and told her and other black students to gather in the lobby. She thought that administrators would call their parents or the police, but instead the principal opened the front door and said, "We can protect you while you're on school property, but now you have to leave," and so on. 1965. What does Trump have to do with this? It's so irresponsible of the Los Angeles Times, but they don't think it's irresponsible because they don't ask. It's not even any longer asked, gee, we agree with this sentiment, but are we being objective journalists? It's not a question that's asked. How do we further social justice? That is the point of the LA Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and so on. We have, let's see. Oh, really? Oh, this isn't. Okay, good. She's a giant, Christine Amanpour, chief international correspondent at CNN.
Much of the press, much of the media was tying itself in knots, trying to differentiate between balance, between objectivity, neutrality, and crucially, the truth. We cannot continue the old paradigm. We cannot, for instance, keep saying, like it was over global warming, where 99.9% of the science, the empirical facts, the evidence is given equal play with the tiny minority of deniers. I learned a long, long time ago when I was covering the genocide and ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, never to equate victim and aggressor, never to create a false moral or factual equivalence, because then, if you do, particularly in situations like that, you are party and accomplice to the most unspeakable crime.
Right. You have no idea.
So I believe
okay, it's enough.
In being truthful,
okay, that's right.
Not neutral.
That's right. They're not neutral. They're not neutral. Because their truth is not my truth. So Bjorn Lomborg can now not appear on CNN if that is followed. She's a disgrace to the profession, but the whole left is a disgrace to the profession. You know what the New York Times has? It's a new feature, This Week in Hate. So every report from the biggest hate group, the largest hate group, not the only hate group, Southern Poverty Law Center, that's what they use, Southern Poverty Law Center. Gives you an idea how far left the New York Times is that they rely on something so radical as the Southern Poverty Law Center. I mean, listen to the hate. Last week, a passenger on a Delta flight began shouting Donald Trump and asked, "We got some Hillary, then B word on here." Guy was probably drunk, and they took him off the plane. I mean, this is America is descent into hate. They're hysterics on the left. They're hysterics. In Astoria, Queens, an Arab-American Uber driver recorded a video of another driver shouting at him that Trump is president and they'll deport you soon. By the way, I don't defend that, but I mean, this is what we've come to? This is the week in hate in America. But Black Lives Matter is not a hate group, right? That is not recorded. There is more attention paid to this than to the murder of policemen. The New York Times and the whole crowd, they are truly morally sick, and they're sickening. I read them every day. There is news to be found there. And anyway, I need to know what the left tells itself. Anyway, I have a very strong suspicion that the target of contempt, old white males, as they pass on to the afterlife, the New York Times subscription is getting lower. I don't think the New York Times subscriber base is proportionately non-white. At a Smith supermarket in Albuquerque, New Mexico, on November 23rd, a woman began shouting Islamophobic abuse at a shopper wearing a hijab. Employees remove the shouting woman from the store. By the way, you know, in some cases, I read to you yesterday, they're hoaxes. The woman, another hijab case, it was completely made up. They never report the hoaxes in the New York Times. Anyway, the beauty is they're increasingly irrelevant. The New York Times is relevant to the mainstream media, but the mainstream media are increasingly irrelevant to Americans.
Coming up.
What was the biggest characteristic of George Washington? He is a guy who turned aside from power. Fidel Castro is a person who embraced power and all his prerogatives and never let go.
How the media handled the death of Castro. Stay with us for the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Cuba is a country filled with poverty, suffering, and abuse. Many have risked crossing the ocean on rickety rafts in an attempt to flee the oppressive island. They'd rather die trying to flee than live under the Castro regime, and sadly, many thousands did. Upon the death of Fidel Castro, many in the media ignored that reality, and others, such as the massive gulag he has operated on his island, his prison complex, the torture, the secret police. They instead embraced the utopian lives of the former dictator himself. Here's Michael Medved.
Compare the lives of Cubans stuck behind in the, quote, island paradise with the lives of Cubans here. And then put in perspective what some folks, morons, in the press have to say about the passing of Fidel Castro, led in this case by Brian Williams, of course, of NBC.
You see the medicine system they are very proud of. You see athletes, and think of how many Cuban athletes have enriched the sports in this country and around.
I'm quite certain that they're not celebrating his death in Cuba.
That's Charlie Rangel.
He got healthcare, and he got rid of Batista, and he make literacy a part of the Cuban government.
Even Castro's critics praised his advances in healthcare and in education.
And he was the original revolutionary.
Considered, even to this day, the George Washington of his country.
Oh, my God.
Fidel continued to promote leftist movements in Latin America, where he remained popular until his death.
Okay, ask people in Venezuela about that. Where now people in Venezuela are getting on little rafts to run away, to get away from that Castro-white hellhole. Can we not acknowledge that Fidel Castro was not only an evil dictator? Here's the point. Comparing to George Washington, what was the biggest characteristic of George Washington? There's a great story. I tell the story in my book, The American Miracle, which has a whole chapter about the miraculous nature of George Washington's life. And it truly was miraculous. And by the way, The American Miracle officially on sale this week. You can get it, find out at our website at michaelmedved.com. And we're doing a live book signing coming up. But there's a story about Benjamin West, who was a famous American painter. And he was painting a portrait of King George III. This is after the revolution was over. And Benjamin West was asked about the king, by the king, while he was painting him. King George asked, what about this man Washington, who commanded the armies? And Benjamin West said, well, he's stepping aside. He doesn't want leadership. And then King George said, if that is true, then he is the greatest man in the world. Okay, this was true of Washington. He served two terms as president. He could have been reelected. He set up the example. He is a guy who turned aside from power. Fidel Castro is a person who embraced power and all his prerogatives and benefited from it mightily and never let go.
Thank you for joining us for Town Hall Review. Tell a friend, sign up for a podcast of our program at townhallreview.com. And be sure to follow us now on Twitter at Town Hall Review. For executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richard, Derek Fowler, and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt. Join us again next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the weekend review program from a perspective you can trust.